You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today our guest is Anna Belinsky-Huber, an environmental lawyer, and so welcome, Anna.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here today, and I think this is going to be a very interesting topic for folks. Before we get started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey back to our valley that resulted in your current career?
Yeah, I would love to. So I'm an environmental attorney, and I actually was born and raised here in the valley between Aspen and Basalt. And I left for undergrad and law school and really didn't see myself coming back here. When you're raised in a small town, sometimes you're excited to leave.
I hear you, yes.
But I, as I was learning more and more about environmental law and policy and advocacy work, which has been my passion since high school. And originally, I think, you know, my goals were go to DC, work on the federal level, like be in some role that's national and on the big stage. And as I was learning more and more, I started to realize that maybe that's not where actually the most effective work is done. And I really felt that when I, in 2013 or 2023, I think it was, just a couple years ago, while I was in law school, I had the opportunity to go to COP28 for the UN Climate Change Conference.
Oh, cool.
And it was in Dubai. And I mean, talk about the biggest stage for climate activism. You're there with all of these people from around the world and all the biggest actors. And as someone who's always wanted to get into environmental activism, like, that's the place to be. And all I could think while I was there doing this work with an amazing organization, I was with Global Choices, doing work on advocacy for the Arctic Circle and Central Arctic Ocean. And it was so clear to me that even though this is the biggest stage, it's not where the work is getting done. It's just pomp and circumstance, it felt like. But the real work of what needed to get done when everyone's talking about the agreements they're entering into and negotiating over the course of those weeks, the real work is down in each valley and each community that's actually making the changes. And the other part that I really realized was how important relationships are and in change making. And that is what ultimately made me want to come back here. I wanted to come back to a place where I was advocating for the land that I had a relationship with and working with people who I trusted and who trusted me. And I think the work, if you're trying to be an advocate in any capacity, it's so much more effective when you're working alongside people who trust you.
For sure. Life's supposed to be about relationships and timing. So, yeah, that's very important. You know, we talked a few months ago at the time you were doing a paper, and now it's been published. So let's get right into discussing the seminal work entitled Rights of Nature, An Argument for Judicial Economy. My question is, why and how did you get involved in arguing legally that nature has inherent rights?
This came, you know, I don't think there was like a catalyst moment for me that I was like, oh, my God, nature has rights. But in undergrad, I double majored in environmental studies and sociology. And over the course of those classes that I took, it really broadened my perspective and ways that we started to question more. And I started to question more through those courses, Anglo-American relationships with our environment and how we engage with it and why we engage with it the way we do. And the more I prodded at that over those years, the more it just seemed so obvious to me that we are in relationship with the land. We are not superior to the land. We are not separate from the land. It is not a commodity for us to manage. It is critical for every part of human existence, and it also it's our life force. It's a breathing entity. And so that that really opened my eyes to just how do we engage with nature? And is that right? Is that wrong? And then as I continued down that, you know, line of thinking and thought processes, I started getting more into indigenous ways of knowing and literature, really talking about the history of many and most indigenous communities and cultures that saw nature as family. Robin Wall Kimmerer, the seminal author whose work is I just absolutely adore, she refers to nature as the more than human world.
Very good.
And so it was that kind of understanding and perspective that really shifted my view on it. And then I knew that I wanted to get into law and policy work. That really interested me as a way of change making. And so I came into law school with that perspective of that nature and humans are reliant upon each other, and we should be in relationship with each other, not managing nature as a commodity. And as I came in with that perspective and then began learning about, you know, in really in depth our environmental laws that exist, I started to realize I think we've outgrown them. I think they came from a really honorable place. I think they've done incredible work. And I also think that over the decades since their enactment, they've gotten to be a little watered down. And also, they've done the work that maybe they're capable of doing. And I think it's time that we start looking at this a little differently. Right? When our environmental laws were originally enacted, we had rivers catching on fire. We had mass casualties from air pollution. And that's we're not having that kind of environmental catastrophe anymore. But we're in a place where I think we need to shift the way we're managing it to get at truly healthy and clean environments in a symbiotic sense.
I have been reading a book called I can't remember the author's name. I guess Kent Newbern. And the title of the book is Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And I have a quote that sort of talks about that indigenous way of looking at the land that I think fits well here. It was the land where our sacred stories took place. It had sacred places on it. Our ceremonies were we have, and we knew the animals, they knew us. We had watched the seasons pass on this land. It was alive, like our grandparents. It gave us life for our bodies and the life for our spirits. We were part of it. And I think that's part of what I appreciate about the Native American looking at the way land is. It's not something you live on, but you live with. In the introduction of your book, you talk about the growing interest in granting natural objects certain fundamental legal rights to exist and flourish. And plus your title, Section 1, is Rights of Nature Legal Movement. Why do you think this legal interest is happening at this time?
Yeah, I think I also love where you're coming from, and I think people are starting to realize that maybe the way we're thinking about nature in an Anglo-Western system, it's gotten us into a lot of trouble. And I think a lot of people are starting to realize that maybe this relationship where fundamentally is what's getting us into trouble. Let's look deeper at the source of the issues that we're dealing with. I also think that the protections have gotten a little watered down, and I think people are starting to feel like their advocacy is getting stalled. It's not working. It's running into roadblocks. And so how can we start getting creative about looking at this in different ways? Then, and an increasing recognition, I really think, of Indigenous people's rights and ways of knowing. I think that there was, you know, centuries of taking Indigenous people's rights away from them and silencing those people. And as we are still struggling with that today, there is growing recognition of that that is a harmful past that we had. There are harmful things that we've engaged in, and maybe we need to be listening to them a little bit more in their teachings and consider their teachings more. And I think as that window is cracked open and those teachings are starting to become a little bit more mainstream and getting into conversations that they weren't getting into earlier, people are having these aha moments of this relationship is different and this relationship maybe needs to be rethought, and our legal systems are mimics of our values.
You come at this from a legal perspective instead of an ethical one, because a lot of people make that argument, that the ethical argument. And as someone who had worked on as a federal employee trying to manage the land, had worked with NEPA, our National Environmental Policy Act, what are the reasons why these laws are not working? Did they get too much into the weeds and forget the original legislative intent? Is that what one of the problems is?
I think it is. I think, you know, my article, and I guess we can sort of zoom out here and first of all just talk about what is the Rights of Nature movement.
That would be good.
And the Rights of Nature movement is very simple. It is a recognition that nature as an entity should have and does have the right to exist and flourish. And that basic concept should be recognized in law. And at the moment, the American legal system is where I'll focus, though this is true across the world in many different legal systems. But the American legal system seems to, and this is where my paper kind of pushes back on this concept, but on a basic level, the American legal system says the environment does not have rights unless it is tied to a person. And if a person is hurt, then we can look at what's going on with the environment. And Rights of Nature says, no, if the environment is hurt, it needs to be fixed because it in and of itself deserves to be healthy and clean and to flourish. And so, what my argument then is, and a lot of papers have come at this from an ethical perspective, which is what this conversation has been so far, I decided I wanted to take a little bit of a different angle. And I looked at really what is the legislative intent for the big four environmental laws? What are their histories? And what is the real language of these statutes when you actually look at the words in the paper? And I would say that they actually give certain rights to nature. You know, they're pushing that envelope more than we're giving it credit. And so I think because of that, a step to giving legal rights to nature would not be as big of a leap as people think it might have been.
Well, and I kind of wonder if you had any pushback from what you've written.
Not yet, but I would welcome that.
Maybe after today. Huh?
Maybe after today. I think, you know, as the argument, it's still a fresh paper. And so maybe as it gets out into the world a little bit more, we'll get some pushback. And I think that's healthy. I think that dialogue is absolutely a good thing. Yeah.
You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Today, our guest is environmental lawyer Anna Belinsky-Huber. What does the present and future hold in regard to granting Mother Nature personhood?
You know, I think that there's a lot of experimentation with that right now. We're in a really interesting time in the world where when you look around to different countries, different tribes, different cities and states that have started to toy with this, what is rights of nature going to look like? There's a lot of experimentation going on with what that could look like. You know, the basic concept comes from traditional ways of knowing from indigenous peoples for millennia. It's not a new concept. It was brought in modern era into Western, you know, Anglo-American legal doctrine from it's really pointed to Christopher Stone in his piece, Do Trees Have Standing? Should Trees Have Standing? From the 1970s. He's the one that really brought it into the conversation in the legal world. But this concept has existed forever. And now we're just starting to toy with what it'll look like. There are places where in New Zealand, they've given a specific river the right to be healthy. Whereas in Ecuador, they've given nature as a whole the right to exist and flourish. In some places they have said this natural object has the right to exist and flourish, and the advocates are decided. We have decided that this tribe or this entity gets to advocate on behalf of this natural object, but only them. Whereas you have wild rice is in the wider band of Ojibwe in Minnesota. They've given wild rice called Manumin the legal right to exist and flourish, and anyone can bring a case on its behalf. There are constitutional ways to do it, and there are, you know, small statutes or municipal ordinances. So there's a lot of experimentation going on right now on the very small scale and the very large scale. And it's a very interesting space to be in with rights of nature, to see which ones are working and which ones are not going to work. And we can kind of start to figure out the way to do this.
That's what I guess I'm interested in is you personally, what would you like to do if you were given a carte blanche to be the leader of this attempt?
I really appreciate the model. And this is, you know, a model that's used commonly in the legal realm of designating advocates for the role of being able to advocate for nature. And I don't know if I know if it's best that there are certain areas or objects or if it's just as a whole that we want to designate nature as having rights. But I do appreciate the concept that there are certain people who have had relationship with this land forever. You know, their creation stories may be tied with the land, or maybe they're nonprofits and advocacy organizations that have been advocating for the land for decades, and they hold a specific role and relationship with the land to be able to effectively advocate for it. And that's a model as a third-party guardian coming in to advocate for another rights-bearing entity or person that has existed for a long time, and I think that that's a really good way to do this.
So guardianship would be one way to do it. Then, mm-hmm. Would you have to? I mean, how would you start? Would you bring something up that's existing and say, "Well, no, this we object to that, and we think this is the best way to approach it"? Or would you introduce a law in Congress in this administration to cause that? What exactly would be the next practical step?
I would hearken back to starting local. I think that is, you know, municipalities can pass ordinances. And that can guide the decision making for your local area. And that gives you the opportunity to maybe think about certain spaces, certain natural objects that are particularly resonant with your community. That's what tribal governments are largely doing. A lot of them are taking specific rivers or plants or areas that have a particular relationship with that tribe. And giving those areas. And so that's one way to do it. I think that's a really effective way that speaks to a lot of people's souls.
Why are other countries ahead of us in situations like this? New Zealand, I understand, had something going on. And you said Uruguay already. So, why are we so still colonial in our thinking, illegally especially?
There's a lot of fear of where this could go, the slippery slope mentality in the United States and other countries as well. And I think the argument against that is kind of simple. Christopher Stone actually brings it up in his article from decades ago that every time rights have been expanded over the course of American history, that was the argument. Oh, this is going to flood the court system. This is just going to be a slippery slope with no way back. You know, it's going to be chaos. When we gave rights to children, when we gave rights to folks that are incarcerated, to people that are black, to any entity or any person that has been given rights over the course of American history, the argument always was, this is going to lead to chaos in the court system, and it never has. And so I think that that's a really good way of looking at, I don't think this could be as dramatic of a change as people may think. And then also, that's my perspective in my paper, is that this is not as big of a step as we think it could be. Now, would this stop? Would this potentially stop or be a tool to stop effectively a lot of oil and gas projects, development projects, dams, that kind of stuff? Yeah, it could. At the moment, you're very familiar with the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, right? That's a stop and look statute is what we call it. That doesn't stop the federal government from allowing that action to take place.
Exactly.
It yes. just tells them to go through the right process and consider all the potential things that may come of that.
It's procedural. I mean, and there's no fines really, basically, attached to it. No financial right. incentives or otherwise.
Right. And so I think that this people are getting hungry for a way to really enact change. And I think the environmental laws, as they are working today, are not feeling like they are creating the change people want to see.
Not fast enough either.
Not fast enough either.
So what can people do that might help this process a little? How could they get more educated, for one thing? I mean, is your paper going to be available to the general public?
My paper is. If you just look it up on Google, it pops up pretty quick. It's in the Natural Resources Journal, titled Rights of Nature, an Argument for Judicial Economy, and it's fully accessible to the public. I think Earth Law Center is a really incredible resource. They're actually headquartered out of Durango.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they have fantastic information, just educational information about what is rights of nature, they have a great timeline on their website you can go through. But just learning about how we can maybe think about this in a different sense. And I would really encourage people to not be afraid of it. It sounds like a big, scary thing, but I think if you look at the legislative intent, if you look at the types of cases that are brought in environmental law, we're already giving legal rights to nature. And it's not as big of a leap to formally codify that. In my paper, I talk about how the field of environmental law has reached a point where I believe we're bending over backwards to say we're not giving rights to nature while simultaneously creating all of these little exceptions that are special to the field of environmental law to maintain that picture. But really we are giving rights here and there. And so because of that, if you really look at the language in the statutes, how they're being used, the standing requirements, how an organization or person can bring a case in court in environmental law, that's different in environmental law field than others. And if you take all that together, what I've argued and what I think is true is that we're giving rights to nature, and to formally codify that would not be as big of a jump as people may fear it is.
So I wonder how we could do that in Carbondale. Seriously, I'd introduce a possible resolution to the town council?
Yeah, I think okay. that if we get some people that are interested, I think that would be a fantastic way to guide our city and our county and put our money where our mouth, or you know, walk the walk.
Right. In the next last couple of minutes that we have, what do you want people to know about this whole movement here that we're talking about for issuing nature the rights it has? It already has, but we just don't recognize it, do we?
Right. Right. You know, I think the biggest thing is just taking a second to question, is nature a tool for me or is it on equal standing with me? Right? Is nature somewhere when we go and we go hiking in the mountains or mountain biking or skiing? Do you feel like this just a commodity? No. You feel in relationship with the land. And I think I would say lean into that. Lean into that and don't be afraid of that. Maybe we are in relationship with it, and maybe that should be formal. And if we injure nature, nature should have rights.
Or else we suffer the consequences, don't we?
We do, but also nature does.
Well, that's true.
And
that's
that should true. Be maybe enough in and of itself.
Sometimes I think we sort of work around the edges by talking about sense of place. You know, when we're there, we talk about the spirit of of nature as if it's something outside ourselves. And really, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for nature. Mm-hmm. And the water we have, we polluted it, so we came up with the Clean Water Act. Mm-hmm. We started polluting the air. And it was the public, the people that are listening, just like the people listening, that decided to do something about it. And at that time, when Congress was functional, Congress did pass some laws that...
bipartisan laws.
Exactly. The Wilderness Act was one, and the rest of these that we talked about. All these laws were supported by the public, and so that's what it takes. Well, thanks so much for coming today. I really appreciate it, Anna. So good to have you here. And thanks for listening to KDNK. Our next For Land's Sake show is the second Monday in July, July 13th at 4:30. Until then, whatever you do, do it for nature's sake.